conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with our co-host, Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we are rejoined by world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual, Professor Henry Giroux. We'll discuss his latest book from City Lights Books' Open Media Series on today's program. The title, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Stay with us.
Crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, far for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by taxes, while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, divine conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame. At the table, then you probably on the
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to have back with us Henry A. Giroux. Henry Giroux is a world-renowned educator, author, and public intellectual. He currently holds the professorship for scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University. His most recent books include The Violence of Organized Forgetting, that's a City Lights book from 2014. Neoliberalism's War on Higher Education, Haymarket, also 2014. Disposable Futures, that's a City Lights book from 2015. Again, you'll notice Henry Giroux is quite a prolific author. And today on the program, we are bringing him back to talk about his brand new release on City Lights Books Open Media Series, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be back, Mickey, always.
It always is great to talk to you, Henry Giroux, and you're very generous with your time, so we're glad that we'll have you on today for the hour. And let's start by talking about your brand new book on City Lights Books. And, you know, you've written about this topic for some time, but this is a few hundred page tour de force, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism, with a foreword by George Yancey. So, Henry Giroux, let's just start from the beginning. The introduction with George Yancey sets the stage for your book really well. Can you talk a little bit about what Yancey introduces for us here and how you selected him?
Well, I think that one of the things that I wanted to make clear in this book is there's an element of what I call neoliberal fascism at work here that is often not talked about when people increasingly talk about the rise of fascism in the United States, and that's white supremacy and what I call racial purity, the logic of racial purity, the discourse of racial purity, and the politics of disposability. I mean, I think that all of these are being accelerated in such a way that you have a kind of capitalism on steroids, not just around questions of the acceleration of profits and the dispossession of people and so forth and so on. It's not just about economic structures, but it's a racial war that's at work that is something that often is underplayed, if not overlooked. And I thought George, particularly given his own absolutely excellent and profound work on questions of race and white supremacy, was a perfect person to sort of introduce this book. There's also something else about George. I mean, I think that there aren't a lot of theorists around who have what I call a comprehensive understanding of politics. A lot of people are sort of stuck in silos, in single-issue movements, which is not to deride those movements, but it seems to me that in many ways you have to put these movements in a much larger context in order to understand both their strengths and their limitations, and also the need for these various movements to come together and be able to speak to each other in terms of a larger project, the project that I would call the promises and the ideals of a radical democracy.
Indeed. And Yancey, also a professor of philosophy at Emory University, historian Carol Anderson also at Emory, and does great work on race and history. So this is sort of the genesis or the crux of what you're getting at here in American Nightmare. And I know both Yancey and you love to quote James Baldwin and really get a sense of urgency, I think, both historically and in context and up to the present. So you start right at the beginning. And again, you don't pull punches here. You start staring into the authoritarian abyss. So in your definition, and again, this is not just about Donald Trump, obviously. This is a 40, 50 plus year slide, neoliberal fascist slide into the situations that we're in. And you go into that in the book. But tell us about how you start out your new book.
What I tried to do initially was to make clear the scope of this disaster. We're not just talking about a guy who is baiting immigrants and so forth and so on. We're talking about a guy who's actually and who has changed the language of fascism, American fascism, in a way that it's totally unapologetic. I mean, this guy takes pride in basically attacking people and attacking people of color and attacking poor people. But I think that what I wanted to make clear was that, you know, if we're really going to talk about fascism, you know, in its emerging forms in the United States, we've really got to talk about education. We've got to talk about the fact that this rationality permeates, economizes, and drives a language that takes humanity out of the discourse. It has nothing to say about questions of justice, has nothing to say about questions of ethics, empathy, compassion. I mean, it's a language that increasingly has expelled democracy from its vocabulary. And I think that's an enormously important thing to understand, because what I'm trying to do in the book is to make clear that neoliberal fascism tells a story. And that story is a story that's undermined and displaced some of the most important principles that make the institutions and the language of democracy possible. I mean, it talks about freedom as the freedom from government, freedom from the interference by others, the freedom to say anything you want, even though it may be racist and it might be derogatory and humiliating. But it also, in a sense, does something dreadful. And I try consistently throughout the book to make this very clear. It individualizes social problems. It basically undercuts the possibility for agency by suggesting that the problems that we face alone, and that we alone are responsible for them. And I think that's one of the most powerful elements of public pedagogy that neoliberal fascism seizes onto. It makes people powerless because they can't translate individual and private problems into larger systemic issues. And I think that develops and produces a sense of enormous powerlessness, enormous rage, enormous anxiety. Couple that with the economic structure, the economic conditions in which people are in a world of, in which they're just basically trying to survive and live in a world of utter uncertainty and precarity. And that's a very lethal combination. And I think that works in many ways throughout the book.
Henry Giroux, you start the book by talking, you literally have the definition of fascism here. I suppose it's still not something in vogue in terms of analysis in the United States. Fascism is one of those terms that sort of comes kicking and screaming through history, and it's attached to the Nazis. It's attached to that earlier era in Spain. It's attached to Mussolini in Italy. The definition, an authoritarian, nationalistic, right-wing system of government and social organization, the general use, you say, extreme right-wing, authoritarian, or intolerant views or practice. Let's go in and talk about, I mean, we're in Trump's America, make America great again, right? That's some pretty significantly coded language. Let's go back historically, and maybe you can walk us through some of this. What is the thread, historically, of fascist ideology, and how do we see it manifest today?
I think that we see it in a whole range of assumptions. At least we saw it in the past. Those assumptions in many ways are quite clear, a sort of appeal to an ultra-nationalism, disdain for human rights, the identification of enemies as a unifying cause, the supremacy of the military, a kind of rampant sexism, control of the media, the notion that America is in a constant state of crisis, a contempt for weakness and dissent, a sort of acceleration of the dark side of hyper-masculinity. All of these are kind of endemic to a generic, I would think in some ways, to a generic fascism, contempt for the rule of law, of course. But I think that one of the things that we have to recognize is that when we often talk about fascism historically, it's sort of seen as something that's stuck in history. You know, it's like a static form that doesn't repeat itself, and that it's basically something that's described as part of a long-lost historical memory, while still frightening, no longer taken too seriously because it's confined to the past. And I think that when you look at people like Hannah Arendt, Timothy Snyder. I mean, a whole range of historians who have been studying this stuff, Robert Paxton, for years. I mean, what they all say is relatively similar, and they say that fascism basically can crystallize into new forms. And I think that what I've tried to do with the book is to talk about how those basic elements of fascism get reworked into today the logic of disposability, America first, a different kind of ultranationalism, the claim that America is in decline, the acceptance of the fact that the political state has become the corporate state, and that's very important. The recognition that cultural sovereignty is all these states have left, meaning that they're defining themselves in terms of a cultural logic and not an economic logic because they no longer have control over their resources, and that the state now simply mobilizes itself in order to make sure that this global elite gets everything they want in terms of financial resources. I think that another thing that we see with respect to this, what I call the mobilizing passions of neoliberal fascism as both a project and as a movement today, is that not only does it produce massive amounts of inequality and suffering and dismantle government agencies and services, but it focuses in such a way, it does this in such a way as to mobilize what I call the passions of fascism. They're not, it's actually not my term. It's Paxton's term.
Mm-hmm. Friendly fascism, actually, what Paxton wrote about, correct?
Yeah, what he wrote about.
Right.
He uses that term, the passions, the mobilizing passions of fascism. And I think that we see that now in an economic system, a neoliberal economic system that's on steroids. I mean, remember, in the past, even when these elements of authoritarianism emerged, you saw a couple of things. You still saw a slight respect for the social contract. You still saw a slight respect for social provisions. You still saw a language that, as cruel as it wasn't arrogant about defining that language so as to wear it like a badge. The racism was somewhat clouded in the discourses of colorblindness and all that nonsense. Now, my God, you've got a language of cruelty, a culture of cruelty. You've got the common good being destroyed or spoken of with utter disdain. You see public spheres being dismantled. You see people running the basic agencies of government in ways to absolutely destroy those agencies if they have anything whatsoever to do with the common good. It's a very different kind of fascism in many ways, driven by an extreme form of capitalism that we haven't seen in the past.
Well, Henry Giroux, it's also the case that this seems to be championed by both leading Democrats and Republicans in Washington, D.C., and across the states. Let's not forget about state politics, where there's an overwhelming number of very right-leaning governors, and we've seen recent Supreme Court rulings.
I'm not suggesting at all that this is simply something that's in the federal government. What I'm suggesting is this project and movement actually encompasses all levels of government, it seems to me, in the United States. And you're right. It's not just about Republicans. That's nonsense. What we really have to ask ourselves is what political parties were at work in different ways and in different degrees in creating the economic and financial conditions that made this massive inequality and this logic of disposability possible. And they both did. Only the Republicans were worse.
Indeed. And we see, though, that the recent Supreme Court rulings seem to champion discrimination, uphold voter suppression. And again, looking at some of these historic hallmarks of fascism, and this is not just the Trump administration, but certainly since Trump has taken office, we've seen profound expressions against immigrants, against women. The administration practically drips with misogyny. The mask has been taken off. Like the neoliberal approaches that have been coming at us for decades, right, under the Obama administration, and certainly you were very critical of the Obama administration. We have it Project Censored. But with the Trump administration, it's as if the mask has come off, and now you're using this term neoliberal fascism.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. The mask has come off, and I think we need to recognize, I mean, we need to recognize two things here. We need to recognize that neoliberalism in many ways has accentuated its own logic of austerity to such a point that the degree of suffering that it's causing at every level, the degree of powerlessness, coupled with an ideology that offers the wrong solutions and misdirects the rage so as to actually reinforce its own essential conditions of power. That's what's so powerful about this. I'm not saying that neoliberalism is fascism. I'm saying that neoliberalism creates the grounds for a kind of fascism in which it's difficult to separate one from the other.
Well, you know, you have a great you have several great epigraphs. One of the epigraphs you have in the book is Michel Foucault, a great quote that says, "The strategic adversary is fascism, the fascism in us all, in our heads and in our everyday behavior, the fascism that causes us to love power, to desire the very thing that dominates and exploits us."
Yeah, yeah.
So can you connect some of that to what you just said?
What I'm trying to say here is that when we talk about, and the left is terrible on this. I mean, the left often talks about fascism in terms of economic conditions, right, and structures. And I think that when you go back to the Frankfurt School, and you go back to people like Adorno and, of course, Horkheimer and Eric Fromm, and, of course, Wilhelm Reich, what they're saying is, be careful. What they're saying is that fascism is internalized. It operates at the level of desire, at the level of psychology, at the level of consciousness, at the level of unconsciousness, so as to create needs and desires and values that basically tie people to forms of oppression that they come to support, but actually ends up oppressing them. And we see this all the time now in the United States, as we all know. People saying, well, yeah, get the government off our backs, but, you know, which means they'll take away their Social Security, take away Medicaid, Medicare, and all the kinds of things that actually keep them practically alive. But I think that what we are really getting at here, I think I'm correct on this, is that we're talking about education becoming central to politics. Vaclav Havel had a term that sometimes is difficult to interpret, but he said, politics follows culture. And what he meant by that is probably in some way unclear but needs to be said, is that consciousness gives rise to politics, certainly in its best and most resisting forms, but also in a way that basically allows people to invest themselves in forms of consciousness and in particular modes of ideology that are utterly destructive and utterly at odds with their own sense of possibility and at odds with their own freedom. And I think that we need to be very clear about why education is so central to politics, that we have two elements of fascism at work as a project and a movement, it seems to me. You have an economic structure, causes massive inequality, distributes wealth upwards. We know all about that, right? You know, eradicates cities, eliminates all kinds of social provisions. And then you have a kind of soft fascism, right? A fascism that operates at the level of needs and desires, which is basically expanded through the cultural apparatuses that have now become the great right-wing teaching machines of the 21st century, whether we're talking about the Pravda version of Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair Broadcasting, or whatever.
Well, I misspoke earlier. You were talking about Bob Paxton, and I was thinking of Gross's book, The Friendly Fascism, The New Face of Power, which goes back decades. And you've been writing about this for a long time. But, you know, so have select others here in the U.S., and it's kind of bewildering, a couple bewildering points here that you've brought up. One is it's pretty amazing how you hear from certain demographics in the population, people saying, get government off my back, but then without certain things the government does, those people would be the very victims of the changes in those policies.
Oh, absolutely.
But the other is, on the other end of the spectrum, in the punditocracy and among educational elites, there's a great aversion to using the F word, right? Fascism.
Oh, no, they're starting to use it now.
It's very recent. And again, I think that one of the unfortunate elements of that is because in the liberal end of the spectrum, it seems that it's because of Trump. And if we could only just take care of Donald Trump, everything would go back to normal. Well, normal wasn't okay.
That's absolutely right. This could have stayed more of one Democratic Party, at least the center-right, right, version. I mean, they're now defining themselves as the party of resistance. And the only way that they can do that is to actually mimic Trump by engaging in the politics of diversion.
Well, this is, again, this is how it's all being, in my view, being driven into the ditch. It's just one distraction after another. It's
right.
Governing by tweet. And the corporate press has just kind of hook, line, and sinker really cheer-led the way from the campaign all the way through now. And the Democrats, I like to call them the Mick resistance with a little trademark sign, right? This is not Democratic engagement. This is not civic engagement, small d Democratic engagement. And again, this is really the politics of division and fear. I'd like to remind listeners that we are speaking with Professor Henry Giroux. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff. After this musical break, we're going to continue our conversation with Professor Henry Giroux about his recent book from City Lights, Open Media Series. It's called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Stay with us.
With that are you home, boy? With that are you home, my daughter? See, I gotta draw a line, I can't take it no more. If you ain't down with revolution, what you waiting for? Making money for suckers and not communities poor. Ripping flags off of coffers, man, this ain't our war. Colonized and terrorized by the world's biggest killers. The US government, the biggest weapon and drug dealers. Filling prisons with children, incarcerating the future. MySpace and Facebook got us stuck on computers. Stuck on stupid bumping music that's abusive to the shorties. And the nonsense that you're spitting, they just listen and absorbing. I've been dormant, I've been woken, I'm a giant, I'm ready. I'm with the Apple in Oaxaca and we hold the machetes.
I rock hard like pellets feeding children holding slingshots. I'm with every single kid that's down for hip-hop. For the culture, the life, what it really stands for. This music is resistance, it's the voice of the poor. I'm on the side of the workers, the teachers and lunch ladies. On the streets with brown mommies, raising our brown babies. I'm with youth organizers, cleaning up the Bronx River. I'm like Jaime Escalante when I stand and deliver.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we're speaking with Professor Henry A. Giroux. He's a world-renowned educator, prolific author, over 60 books, and public intellectual. He's at McMaster University up in Canada. Henry Giroux, we mentioned earlier education, the role education plays. So I wanted to revisit that, not only through the privatization of education, but through the deconstruction of the public sphere and the attack on public education. I think that's really been a Trojan horse for a lot of these myopic, market-driven agendas. And so how do you see that as sort of getting us to the crisis we're at?
I think that one of the things that we've seen increasingly over the last 40 years is not just that education basically is being undermined in terms of being discarded as failing. They claim it's failing because it's public. That's why they claim it's failing. But I think that you're right. When you look at the lack of funding, the defunding of public education, when you look at the move towards charter schools, the privatization, when you look at the attempt in many ways to increase the segregation that goes on in schools by rewarding some schools and, of course, those that are basically black and brown and poor with no funds whatsoever by punishing teachers and going after public servants by claiming that unions are basically on the side of injustice and do nothing to promote the rights of children. I mean, this is a full-fledged attack on the very concept of the public and on the concept of the public good. And schools are particularly dangerous for these people because they realize that at some level, it's conceivable that those schools hold the promise of actually educating people to think. I mean, the attack on public education amongst all of its various registers is really an attack on the radical imagination. It's really an attack on the ability of an institution to say that we need to educate people not only to be morally responsible, but to be critical citizens. And I think that schools are seen as enormously dangerous, just as the oppositional media, as another form of education, is seen as enormously dangerous. But I think that the endless neoliberal attack by these billionaires, by these conservative institutions, by the think tanks, it's a war on public education, higher education, and it's a war on youth. And it's a war on teachers, and it's a war on students.
This is Chase Palmieri. Henry, one quick question for you. You talked about how education, higher education, is the solution here, and you just mentioned again how billionaires are influencing the universities, turning them more into training grounds. Can you talk about practical ways, as you mentioned in your recent profile on Truthdig, about how billionaires like the Koch brothers are actually going about attacking these institutions?
What they're doing is, it's really quite remarkable. I mean, they're doing a number of things. First of all, they're putting enormous amounts of money into educating people to go into the schools, these ideologues, whether they be students or whether they be faculty, and actually begin to mobilize all kinds of right-wing clubs, newspapers, all the kinds of things that would basically be seen as part of an extracurricular set of activities to do everything they can to push the alt-right and the neoliberal ideologies that they support. Secondly, they're giving enormous amounts of money to schools and asking them to set up institutes in their names. In some cases, they're giving money to these universities, and they're actually on the boards that choose faculty, which is stunning, hard to believe. You look at places like George Mason University, and right, it's like the Koch University. I mean, the Koch brothers university, they have given so much money to that school that they're beginning to exercise enormous influence, not only over who might get hired, but what priorities are given to what knowledge formations, what fields become crucial. They're pushing free market economics. They're saying, look, we'll give you millions. put together a free market set of courses, if not a school, and we'll support this. And, of course, schools being underfunded, particularly in public education, many of them losing as much as 50% of their funding over the last 30 years, in many cases are more than willing to do that. And you know what the implications of that might be. Thirdly, you see a lot of people in higher education are actually affiliated with the corporations and the boards that the Koch brothers push. So they go on, or they become part of the advisory groups. And all of a sudden, there's an enormous conflict of interest. They're getting like $200,000 a year to be on these boards, and they're then setting policy and sitting in on decisions as to who gets tenure. Now, couple that, again, with a fourth movement that's pushed by the billionaires, and that is they're increasingly talking to and doing everything they can to talk to trustees to sort of do away with tenure, do away with long-term faculty, do away with tenured positions. In Wisconsin, now, the governor of Wisconsin,
Scott Walker,
has, for all intents and purposes, eliminated tenure. He's eliminated tenure. Well, and he's basically in bed with the Koch brothers.
But that's why state politics and local politics are really key places, and one might argue key battlegrounds, right? Because of people like the Koch brothers who have infested the university and are really moving to get rid of critical people like you, Henry, someone that does, not only are you a public intellectual, but, you know, you're a critical pedagogy scholar. I mean, this is really at the core of what it means to be a critical thinker, to go through higher education, to get a so-called liberal education. And these groups like the Koch brothers and others, including organizations like Project Veritas, they're trying to purge those voices and really expunge critical pedagogy from the curriculum. But this is also why, on the local level, this is maybe one of the few areas where people might be able to fight back, because the national political arena is completely infested with money, billionaire money, dark money, PACs, etc. It's almost impossible to get anybody that even uses language that people that study the public sphere or respect small-d democratic Republican government would get. I'm not writing off national politics, but I'm curious about this, given that we are seeing these assaults on multiple layers of government. Do you think that we have a chance to push this back again at the local and state level?
Mickey, I'm with you on this, actually. I really think that local politics is central, because that's where people live. That's where they can get involved in narratives and struggles that really, in a sense, touch their lives in a very immediate way, whether it's a struggle over public education or whether it's a struggle over higher education. It seems to me that the more abstract these issues become to people, particularly people who are new to politics, the more easy it is to fall into a sense of cynicism and powerlessness. So at one level, I think it has to begin somewhere in ways that touch people's lives so they can have a sense that it matters to them, and they can identify with causes in ways that changes can take place that people can be connected with. The other side of this is that hopefully, as these local struggles emerge, they become broader. Even at the local level, you can struggle over public education, but then realize that what you're really struggling against is the issue of massive inequality and a kind of capitalism that's going to destroy all notions of the public good. So yeah, I think that's very important. I mean, I think that in the best of all worlds, we have our feet in three or four places. But I think if we're talking about beginnings and we're talking about change that basically can be seen in a very immediate sense, that would empower people to engage in broader kinds of struggles, for me, I don't think there's any question but that the importance of the local level.
So, Henry, you've talked about how the mask has recently come off, revealing what you call the nightmare of neoliberal fascism. I'm wondering if long-term you feel that this mask coming off might be a good thing.
It's a terrific thing. I think that one of the things that has happened with this ruling elite is that they're unapologetic now. We live in a very different era politically, right? This is what's different from the older people who talked about fascism. Power is separated from politics. Power is global. Politics is local. And it seems to me that what that means is that they don't care about nation states anymore. You know, they don't care about apologizing to people. They don't care about legitimating ideologies. That's not to say they don't have cultural apparatuses that operate in doing everything they can to produce them and legitimate them. But I think that they feel more emboldened to act in their own interest in ways that allows them to feel that they can act with impunity. The whole enterprise has become more criminogenic. It's more criminal-like in both its attitude and in its practices. In that sense, the contradictions become increasingly difficult to hide. And I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. My lovely wife, Susan, always says, give example. I've been reading recently, and I'm sure, Mickey, you know about this. I was surprised to read that when people talk about at the local level where the most important kinds of politics are taking place, they were talking about the red states. They were talking about these women who are organizing locally and nationally all over these red states around local elections, going door to door, holding educational groups. I was shocked. We never hear about this in the mainstream media. It's much too frightening to talk about. And I think in that sense, what Trump has done has made so clear what the contours of fascism are like. The war on women, the war on young people. Look at these young kids in Parkland who all of a sudden are saying, adults have let us down. I'm sorry. You know, you've written us out of the script of democracy. To be voiceless is to be powerless. And we're not going to put up with this anymore. You are not going to speak for us. And we are going to vote out anybody who supports the NRA. I mean, wow. In that sense, what are we seeing? We're seeing the bare face of neoliberal organizations, economic, political, ideological organizations that really can't legitimate themselves anymore. When you have a mass shooting a week, and students are being killed all over the place, black people are being assaulted by the police, you know, for just walking down the street. It seems to me that something has to give. The language of everything's okay, there's no such thing as an alternative, everything is getting better, trickle-down theory is stunning and works, has exhausted itself. Now we need a new language. Remember Gramsci's saying, you know, the old is dying and the new is about to be born. And in the middle is a period of both barbarism and hope.
Well, Henry, I'm glad you brought up the students and youth. And you write about in the introduction of your book, you actually have a great quote from a Carnegie Knight investigation that says, for every U.S. soldier killed in Afghanistan during 11 years of war, at least 13 children were shot and killed in America. Every day in the United States, 7 kids and teens are shot dead, which adds up to 2,500 dead children a year. When is this going to sink in?
When it becomes more obvious and more visible.
Well, that's what Parkland, that's why Parkland was attacked immediately. And look who the victims were there too, right?
Right. I mean, you know, can you imagine this right-wing nonsense, these nonsense media machines claiming that David Hogg was an actor, or InfoWars, that moron from InfoWars.
Alex Jones. Right. Let's call him by name.
I mean, Alex Jones claiming it never took place and it was staged. Yeah. Fortunately, he's being sued now by these parents. I think that what we're getting at here is that the level of the spectacle has become so insane, so conspiracy theory ridden, that while at some level, of course, there's a base that believes all this stuff, and they'll believe it right to the end. But there are more and more people who are realizing that we're not just talking about lies and the consistencies of lies. We're talking about a culture of cruelty that is so at odds with any sense of humanity, so at odds with any sense of justice, so at odds with any sense of democracy that people are saying, we've had enough.
Well, Henry Giroux, I actually want to continue on that point. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff, in studio with Chase Palmieri. And we'll continue our conversation with Professor Henry Giroux after this musical break. Stay with us.
How could this be the land of the free, home of the brave, indigenous Holocaust, and the home of the slaves? Corporate America dancing offbeat to the rhythm. You really think this country never sparks a terrorism? Human rights violations, we continue the saga. El Salvador and the Contras and Nicaragua. And on top of that, you still want to take me to prison just because I won't trade humanity for patriotism. It's like MK Ultra controlling your brain, suggestive thinking, causing your perspective to change. They want to rearrange the whole point of view of the ghetto. The fourth branch of the government wants to settle a bandana full of glittering generality, fighting for freedom and fighting terror. But what's reality? Read about the history of the place that we live in and stop letting corporate news tell lies to your children.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. Henry Giroux is a world-renowned educator, author, public intellectual. We are speaking with Henry for the hour today about his newest book. It's out right now on City Lights Books. It's City Lights Books' open media series, and Greg Ruggiero does a fantastic job editing that series. Henry's new book is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. And Henry, before the break, you were really breaking down this culture of cruelty, and we had been talking about youth. And I want to go back to this because, you know, again, in the beginning, in the introduction of your book, you know, you really lay out what's going on with young people from the juvenile justice system, debtor's prison for kids, which is a story we covered in Censored 2018, the school shootings, and the utter anti-intellectual practice of testing and rote memorization. It seems like schools are training grounds for this neoliberal fascist future, no?
Yes, absolutely. We need to situate that in a way that makes it more understandable. Remember, you know, as the social state begins to disappear under neoliberal austerity measures, one of the things that takes its place is the punishing state. And what that means is that the prison becomes the model in many ways for a lot of institutions, not all, but many. And schools are certainly one of them. And we have what somebody else once called punishment creep, this increasing criminalization of behavior on the part of both the state and federal governments in ways that basically make students suspects. I mean, think about what's going on in schools. I mean, students now are learning that schools are really about fear, security, not being able to trust anyone, and that the police are basically the most valuable resources they have in the school. That means you're educating a generation to believe that what really matters about schools doesn't matter at all.
Not only do we have that, we also have a lack of due process, a lack of transparency, a bloated administrative budget that cuts supplies from students and tax teachers, a corporate press and chamber of commerce in bed with the school boards that don't support teachers or students. And right here in my own hometown in Petaluma, we just saw the high school censor a valedictorian speech of a young woman who was sexually assaulted. And the school was trying to keep it under wraps, and they censored her speech. They told her she wasn't supposed to say it. She ended up reading it anyway. Fortunately, in this town, a lot of people have been coming to this young woman's defense, and I'm heartened to see that. But I've yet to hear any real definitive statement from the administration that makes any sense at all, other than one of sheer authoritarianism.
I think it's indicative of the utter lack of courage that some administrators have, who have sort of jumped in bed with this notion that schools are really about killing the imagination and censoring students and making life difficult for them and putting them in classes that are overcrowded, that lack resource, while at the same time, of course, the other side of this is punishing teachers, de-skilling them. You know, the endless number of stories we hear about teachers who now have two or three jobs in order to survive, who have to buy materials out of their own pockets for their kids, who give increasing amounts of time to children at the expense of their own families. I mean, this is outrageous. I mean, this is truly, when we talk about neoliberalism's culture of cruelty, what we really need to do is to change the language. We're talking about a war on youth. We're not just talking about youth who are being shortchanged. We're talking about a full-fledged war on the presupposition that the greatest index by which we can measure any society is how it treats its youth. And clearly, in this phase of neoliberal fascism, the United States has not failed. It's actually a failed state.
I'm afraid you're correct about that. That's why I'm kind of focusing here. I know the rest of your book is about many, many things, but I can't help but get away from how symbolic it is in terms of what's happening with the youth in this country.
Oh, it's just unreal. I mean, it's symbolic in multiple ways, right? In both dreadful and helpful ways. I mean, at one level, there's what we've talked about, you know, anything from the debtor prisons, I mean, to children being, their behavior being criminalized in schools, to increasing numbers of students being ushered into the school-to-prison pipeline. We have all of that. But at another level, we have students speaking out, like this young girl. You know, we have students mobilizing. We have the Black Lives Matter movement and a whole range of movements in which young black and brown people are mobilizing, using the new social media, talking to each other across national boundaries, as well as Me Too and Time's Up. And so it seems to me there is an ecosystem, an echo chamber, a culture emerging that in many ways, even without the platform of the mainstream media, is beginning to do something crucial, and that is the need to change the language, the need to rethink the very nature of politics, and to stop equating democracy and capitalism.
That's a key point, Henry. And another one of the reasons that I'm really appreciative of your scholarship over the years and so many books is that by day I'm an historian. And so teaching history as well as critical media literacy, but teaching history in particular is providing relevant context for young people in particular, people of all ages, of course, but young people in particular to realize that they're not in an historical vacuum and that we got here somehow. Right? We have deliberately been driven to this current state. The corporate media wants to pretend it isn't happening or that it's normal. The plutocratic oligarchs are kind of busy fighting over the billionaire class and global domination. Meanwhile, things are decaying on multiple layers of the social strata.
When questions of historical consciousness no longer become relevant, when people can't learn from the past in a way to recognize problems that existed then that are now reproducing themselves in different forms today, politics ends. The lessons of history are not just pedagogical, they're political in the most profound sense, because that notion of consciousness is actually central to having the long view of what it means to move beyond a culture of immediacy, to move beyond a culture of shock, to move beyond a culture that trivializes and spectacularizes everything, and begin to understand that there are other languages. There were modes of resistance. People did struggle, even in the face of the most obscene and overwhelming odds. The Berlin Wall fell. It fell. Women have risen up. Young people have fought in the streets. Black people have taken their bodies and basically put them in places where they were assaulted in order to make sure that the war of injustice became the war of justice. So it seems to me that without historical memory, without this sense of what the past can teach us in terms of what we need to know and what we need to go beyond, is absolutely essential. And one could argue, of course, that the war on youth and the war on education is inextricably linked to the war on memory and historical consciousness.
Indeed, it is. And there's not only, of course, the war on the press, right? President Obama had a war on whistleblowers, to be sure. It went after more of them than any president. And here we have President Trump, the war on the press, right? He's constantly dragging the corporate media into this charade of fake news, right? And the real problem with that is that there is a fake news problem, because fake news isn't new. It's propaganda and it's disinformation. But the way that it's currently been weaponized and used, the president has been pulling the corporate media into it. And now they're using this as a Trojan horse to attack independent voices. I link this directly. The attack on the press is the same as the attack on memory, the attack on historical narrative, and the attack on emerging historiography, from the suppression of Howard Zinn all the way then to the banning of things like Counterpunch through Propernot and the Washington Post. These things are, in my mind, they're very, very linked. Today's fake news is tomorrow's fake history. And what we see happening in the establishment and the Trump administration and on down this neoliberal fascist manifestation is it's using these kind of terms to shut down debate, to shut down factual counter narratives, and actually punish people for trying to explore them.
It has three elements. First of all, it creates a world in which it's impossible to separate fact from fiction, falsehood from reality. Thirdly, it does something else. It eliminates the ethical imagination, the ability for people to distinguish between good and bad. Because when people don't believe informed judgments matter based on evidence, based on historical consciousness, based on memory, based on a certain notion of shared reality, they're open to a kind of fascist ideology. They're open to the assumption that anything can be said, anything can be true, and it doesn't matter what you believe in, and you don't really have to worry about being able to recognize the evil things that people do to people or how evil institutions work. Fourthly, it seems to me it does something that I would say offers a larger, capacious term for everything you've just talked about. It destroys civic literacy. It's an attack on civic literacy.
This is all part, in my view, it's all part of this neoliberal fascist slide. And again, I mean, we can go back a ways, but I really see it coming out of a reaction to the civic movements and engagements and social justice movements in the 1960s, coming out of the Lewis Powell memo and Nixon and the right-wing purge of civic society.
Nobody wants to talk about this. Nobody wants to talk about the fact that they never got over what happened in the 60s. Whether we're talking about the Powell memo or whether we're talking about the Trilateral Commission report, they talk about the excesses of democracy. The thought that people from different groups, different identities, could actually go into the university and come out and in some way be active and critical citizens, the notion that the university could be defined as a democratic public sphere, the notion that we could expand the culture and the institutions that made democracy possible so frightened them that they would rather turn to authoritarianism and fascism than to turn to even a weak social contract and a weak notion of democracy in order to defend it.
That's where we are, Henry. And this is why I'm glad you're riffing on this. And this is another reason why, again, I think you're certainly well-known in your field. In my view, your books should be on everybody's coffee table. I mean that you're someone that connects all these historical dots and puts it all together. Nolan Higdon and I actually just finished a book earlier this spring, and we're hoping it'll be out on City Lights later in the year. But it hits on this very point, that the right wing never got over how democratic and public institutions could be used in the public interest and for the public good, and might chip away at their overall cultural and political hegemony.
And by the way, you are one of the few people who really does this. And I say this because it is so central to any form of emancipatory politics. You have to connect these dots. You've got to bring these issues together so you realize and become aware of how they mutually inform each other. Or otherwise you're caught, you're lost. You know, you're lost in silos that will never tell you enough.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm in studio here with Chase Palmieri. And we are speaking with public intellectual and scholar, prolific author, Professor Henry Giroux. We're going to conclude our conversation with Henry Giroux after this musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Chase Palmieri. On today's program, we're speaking with the renowned author and public intellectual Henry Giroux. He currently holds the professorship for scholarship in the public interest and the Paulo Freire Distinguished Scholar Chair in Critical Pedagogy at McMaster University. His most recent book is American Nightmare, and we're talking about neoliberal fascism. And we're now going to go into our final segment of our conversation. And Chase Palmieri, I think you have a question for Henry.
Yes, Henry, you mentioned how politics takes its lead from culture. So I'm wondering if by that theory that all fascism takes rise as a populist movement.
I think that populist movements are always a part of fascism. They're central to fascism. They're not the only force. But I think that when we ignore the way in which culture functions so as to misdirect rage, so as to instill in people the most racist logics, to make the claim to racial purity, to lead people to believe that only hierarchies matter. I mean, think about this public intellectual who's emerged here, Jordan Peterson in Canada. They call him a best-selling public intellectual. He's an anti-public intellectual. And the nonsense that this guy preaches, that young people are sort of flocking to, you know, women should be in their place, men have to exert this really tough kind of masculinity, this kind of regressive crap we've seen attacked for the last 200 years, all of a sudden in the media becomes fashioned on as part of the spectacle that allows them to increase their audiences and their profits. And all of a sudden, you know, it feeds into the alt-right movement. But in the reading that I do about the 30s and the 40s and the rise of fascism in Italy and what happens in Germany, the question of culture is absolutely central to those movements. The ways in which you could take the collective imagination and rethink it, reformulate it, so as to have it turn against itself so that it had nothing to do with democracy and everything to do with fascism or everything to do with genocide or everything to do with the logic of disposability and militarization. It's just amazing. I think that when we underestimate the educative nature of culture, when we underestimate the fact that education is central to politics, especially at this moment, when all of a sudden you have this new media, you have a very powerful set of cultural apparatuses, and you have a politics and a notion of power that integrates with them in ways unlike we have ever seen before, ever. I'm old. This is a different age. I wrote my books with a pen and pencil and typewriter. Wow. The way in which knowledge now, diffusing of politics, knowledge, identity, and agency, it's taken on the distinctiveness unlike we've ever seen before. And the left still has to catch up with this.
I think so. And Henry Giroux, it's also the case that just because our technology is one click, one tweet, one like or share away, we can't think any faster. And a lot of these issues that are going on are complicated and they have long historical roots. And that takes time to process, integrate, and understand. And in our current technocratic culture, we don't seem to want to take the time or don't make the time or don't have the time because of other pressures in the economy working against us. So this is quite a confluence here that we're facing.
I mean, there are two logics at work here, right? You've pointed to both of them. And for me, they're central to my work. One is that let's make it clear that time is a deprivation for most people. Most people are not dealing with what it means to get ahead. They're dealing with what it means to survive. This is the age of precarity. There are no longer long-term jobs. Everybody's burdened down by loans if they're students and young people, or they're working in jobs that are meaningless, or they're working for free, or they're not working at all. Secondly, it seems to me, we're bombarded by a culture that lives in the moment. Words now can't catch up with thoughts. It's increasingly difficult to do that. Nobody reads books anymore. Everybody's online. Couple that with the social atomization that we see emerging everywhere in the United States. I mean, you know the figures. More people commit suicide in the United States than basically are killed in the opioid crisis and by cars.
Well, indeed. And we know more people in the military are committing suicide than dying in the imperial wars. It goes on and on. Henry Giroux, I would be really remiss if I missed this opportunity because you have a fantastic chapter, one that's central to a lot of the things that I teach. You have a whole chapter on George Orwell and Aldous Huxley. And of course, you talk about the Orwellian nightmare and the dystopian surveillance state. And of course, not long ago, Edward Snowden quipped that Facebook is basically a surveillance company rebranded as social media. He basically said it was one of the greatest propaganda achievements since the Department of War called itself the Department of Defense. But you also write about Huxley, and Neil Postman wrote about this in Amusing Ourselves to Death, this juxtaposition. You talk about Huxley's world of manufactured ignorance. Can you expand a little on that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I was trying to say was that under neoliberal fascism and the rise of the corporate state, we have the emergence of massive disimagination machines. And those disimagination machines are the contemporary version of Huxley's notion of soma. You know, they put people to sleep. They promote lies. They talk about fake news as a way to simply divert all kinds of criticism and to not make power accountable, while at the same time to disparage dissent and to threaten those people who produce dissent. So it seems to me that unlike many theorists who will either pit Huxley and of course Orwell against each other, I claim you have to understand them in this day and age as merging.
It seems like a 1-2 punch to me, and I think that your approach to it is spot on.
Henry, I know you speak to education as one of the solutions here, but I'm wondering if you can address this question. In order to defeat a fascist uprising while it's taking place, would a society have to realign itself within a different competing populist movement?
Yes, absolutely. Chase, if I'm interpreting the question correctly, it seems to me that we need to rescue the notion of populism from simply its right-wing versions. Nobody wants to talk about Sanders. That was a populist movement. Nobody wants to talk about the Parkland students as a new form of populism. Nobody wants to talk about these teachers all over the red states who are walking out and protesting and striking. And I mean, when we talk about populism, all we talk about are right-wingers. This is It doesn't work because it's a way of suggesting on the part of the mainstream press that the only populism that matters is a populism of people who are basically, in their terms, dumb, stupid. They don't know anything. They're ignorant. This is nonsense. That's just another way of basically disparaging working class people. That's how I read that. But I think that Chase is absolutely right. Let's go back. When we talk about Vaclav Havel's notion that politics follows culture, we need to take what it means to change consciousness seriously in ways in which the educational apparatuses that we deal with, whether they be in the schools, in higher education, whether they be in the marginalized media, these all matter. Chase had asked me a question earlier that we didn't follow up on. He says, well, you know, I talk about higher education as structures of domination. They are structures of domination, but they're also structures of struggle. Domination is never so overwhelming that the only way you can talk about power in those institutions is by making it synonymous with domination. I never believed that. I don't believe that for any institution.
You know, Henry, another thing too, and again, we're about out of time here, but this is what I, again, really cherish about your arguments in your books, is that you do bring it back around like we just did, and you write at the end of your book that the American nightmare is not something happening somewhere else to someone else. It's happening here to us. The time to wake up is now. And you end with a great quote from James Baldwin in a letter to Angela Davis. Again, it's very timely. And you write, according to Baldwin, some of us, white and black, know how great a price has already been paid to bring into existence a new consciousness, a new people, an unprecedented nation. If we know and do nothing, we are worse than the murderers hired in our name. If we know, then we must fight for your life as though it were our own, which it is, and render impassable with our bodies the corridor to the gas chamber. For if they take you in the morning, they will be coming for us that night. And you say that in the end, there's no democracy without informed citizens, no justice without a language critical of injustice, and no change without a broad-based movement of collective resistance. Hear, hear, Henry Giroux. Again, I could not agree more. Thank you so much for your important work. Your latest book is called American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. It's out now on City Lights Books, open media series. Henry Giroux, could you direct our listeners to a website and places where they can follow your work? And I really want to promote the work that you do, and I want our listeners to be able to find it.
My website is www.henryagiroux.com. But I also want to direct people to a whole range of websites. I mean, that places like Truth Out, places like Truth Dig, places like Salon, places like Counterpunch, Rise Up Times, Alternet. There is a range of sources out there that are really informative and smart and need to be discovered and read.
Henry Giroux, thanks so much for joining us again on the Project Censored show. Always a delight to hear from you and hear your thoughts about what's going on around the world and, of course, here in the United States. Your latest book, American Nightmare, Facing the Challenge of Fascism. Henry Giroux, thanks for joining us on the Project Censored Show.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians. Cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host and executive producer, Mickey Huff. I was joined today by our new co-host, Chase Palmieri. Peter Phillips and I established the Project Censored Show in 2010, and we're now on over 40 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. Anthony Fest is our senior producer. Our associate producers are Dennis Murphy and Mitch Scorza. To learn more about the Project Censored Show, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook and other social media. To learn more about how you can support Project Censored, go to projectcensored.org. And specifically to support the radio program, you can go through our Patreon account at Project Censored. We'll see you next time.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by criminal minds, political ties, habitualized alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics of the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little poison. The weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons build the capacity, citizens hypnotized by the master thief. Combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that.